It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Downtown Pittsburgh and points north, east, south, and west will all see some traffic restrictions and eventual improvements when PennDOT begins its 2020 construction season. Cheryl Moon Sirianni is the executive for Pennsylvania Department of Transportation's District 11, which covers Allegheny and Beaver County. Cheryl, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You have some projects that you began in 2019 that are continuing this year, including the Interstate 579 cap. What does that really involve?
Well, that project itself, if you've noticed, a couple of the piers have already been built. They're going to build a park over top of the interstate. There's a lot of work to be done in a very tight space. So there'll be a lot of traffic restrictions here over the next 2 years, actually.
Yeah, so that's a long-term project. So it's a park space, green space, pedestrian walkway. So it seems like a nice thing other than just something bridging over top.
What's connecting the communities, the downtown Pittsburgh to the communities above in the Hill District there? That's the whole purpose of the project.
How much is PennDOT involved in that? Because I think maybe, at least I think of PennDOT, I think of roads, bridges. I don't think of green space per se.
Well, this is actually a project sponsored by the Sports and Exhibition Authority to help with some of the development up in that area. And why PennDOT is involved is because there's quite a bit of federal money in the project, and all the federal money has to be managed by PennDOT. Plus, we're building over a major interstate with 50,000 vehicles a day, so we really have to take quite a good look at what's going on.
All right, 50,000 vehicles a day. So how is this going to affect motorists, say, this year?
Well, the continuation of the ramp from the 579 North ramp to 7th Avenue is going to be closed the entire length of the project, so the contractor has somewhere to stage. So that's one area that's going to be impacted for till end of next year. The 7th Avenue and Bedford Avenue ramps, which closed last week, are going to be closed for 140 consecutive days, so you still have quite a few more months left of that closure. And then you're going to have some overnight closures northbound and some overnight closures southbound while we continue to build all of that, the infrastructure in that area.
Is this a sort of a different project for PennDOT than the ones I sort of alluded to before, you know, road repaving, you know, restructuring bridge infrastructure?
Well, yes and no. The actual construction of a bridge itself is our bread and butter. We do bridges all the time, piers, all that. And now once we start getting to the top and building the bike paths, the stormwater management, those type of facilities, that's a little bit different than our normal bread and butter.
Mm-hmm. Some other carryovers, the West Carson Street project located between the West End Circle and the Smithfield Street Bridge. What's happening here?
Well, West Carson Street project was started last year, and we just have to finish up paving that this year. So we're hoping to have that done by June.
Okay, so that was now to the east. You're continuing work on Route 22 around Monroeville. What does this involve? And again, this is sort of short term this season.
Yeah, that project's almost done. Also, we had a lot of base repair, some slides to fix, and some bridge work. This year, we're just going to be basically paving that project from Route 48 the whole way to the county line. And we're hoping to get that done early in the year.
So taking it all the way to Westmoreland County.
Yes, we are.
We're talking about ongoing and upcoming roadway projects with PennDOT's Cheryl Moon Sirianni. On to some new projects for 2020. Seems like several of them involve bridges. Let's start with the Neville Island Bridge. What's going to be done here?
Yeah, if anybody drives 79, I think you could tell that the Neville Island Bridge is in need of a little bit of paint and need a little bit of attention. We haven't worked on it for a while. So it will be, it's actually going to really get going the middle to the end of this year. And most of the work is going to be actually done in 2021. You'll see steel repairs. You won't see any major traffic impacts this year. Most of the major impacts will occur next year. You'll see some night closures of one lane and maybe some shoulder closures this year. Most of the impacts will be in 2021.
More restrictions next year?
Yeah, and I'm going to tell you why in a second.
All right.
why we're not restricting it this year is because we're going to have work done on the Swickley Bridge. That bridge has had a lot of what we call pop-outs on the deck, and we really have to do some work and put a latex overlay on that bridge deck. So that work is actually going to be taking place this year.
Okay, so why? Is it because they're in the relative same area, or is it, hey, we need to address this more immediately, and here's where the funding is going to go? What?
Here's what happened. Neville Island had been programmed for a while, so Neville Island had been ready to go, but the Swickley Bridge deck got so bad, we couldn't wait much longer than this year. So we really had to address it, and we apologize for doing both bridges at the same time. It's just a need we have to address this year.
Okay. And back to the Neville Island Bridge. That is long-term. You said more restrictions next year, but that actually I understand. Will that carry into 2022 as well?
It probably will, finishing up. There's a lot of work that'll probably finish up in 2022.
All right. Some major multi-year work will start on East Carson Street. We mentioned earlier West Carson. What are you going to be doing on East Carson? How long is that going to take?
Well, we're pretty excited about this project on East Carson. It's going to run from Smithfield Street Bridge all the way down to 33rd Street. And this is actually the number one high crash corridor in our region. And it's the number two highest pedestrian crash location. So we're going to put some bump outs, which is...
What are bump outs?
I was just going to say, but bump outs are when you take the curb out further, so you have a shorter distance to cross the roadway. It's also a traffic calming. It calms the vehicles from speeding through the area. We're going to update all of the signals, put in high type crosswalks. They're high visibility crosswalks. We're trying to make some major improvements down at the Birmingham Bridge, so the bikers have a way to come off the bridge and then get back under the bridge rather than crossing that busy intersection there. Mm-hmm. So this is a really good project. It's going to take a couple years, but there'll be a lot of great improvements when we're done.
Do the bump outs shrink the width of the vehicle lanes?
Well, it doesn't really. What it does is it goes into the part where the parking lanes are. So it actually pumps out to about the end of the parking lane. Mm-hmm. And that what that does is it for a vehicle driving, it looks like you're kind of shrinking it down a little bit.
One more related to a bridge, but also roadway, Route 28 at the Highland Park Bridge interchange. That's another multi-year project.
Right. That's one of our biggest projects that are coming out. We knew this was coming when we did the 28 projects down now that near the Heinz plant there. We knew the next bottleneck was going to be at the Highland Park Bridge interchange. It goes down to one lane. What we're going to do is northbound and southbound, we're going to create two through lanes. Quite a bit of work needs done to do that. There'll be a lot of walls built both in the median. There'll be noise walls on the outside. Very tight space to work. We'll also be fixing all those ramps that connect to the Highland Park Bridge and to the Aspinwall-Sharpsburg area.
As a Route 28 user, how's this going to affect me?
We're going to be trying to maintain traffic as it exists today as much as we can. You'll see a lot of night work, and you'll also see a lot of weekend work, a lot of closures on the nights and weekends. There will be a couple long-term closures of the ramps when we have to reconstruct them. This one is a very, like I said, very tight area, and we're looking forward to getting this project done, as are the travelers like you that use 28.
All right. Any other project I haven't mentioned that you want to make sure our listeners know about?
Well, there's a couple. There'll be paving on 28 between Millvale and Highland Park that's going to be starting right out of the gate here in the spring. That'll mostly be night and weekend closures. And then there's a big bridge, a bridge with a lot of traffic over near Swissvale called the Kenmar Bridge.
Right.
We're actually going to build a temporary bridge next to that one. That's right by the Port Authority Park and Ride there, and it's right in between Swissvale and Rankin, a big connection to Kennywood. So we're going to build a temporary bridge so traffic can be maintained. But when we're all done with the project in 2 years, there'll be a 75-day closure to tie everything back together. So you'll see a lot of activity out there also.
Our guest on the Confluence is PennDOT District 11 Executive Cheryl Moon Sirianni. Last week, part of Route 51 in Moon Township was closed because of a landslide. Recently, is it Reese or Rice Run Road?
Reese Run.
Reese Run Road in Ross reopened after 6 months, although that was due to, they were both due to landslides, and one was because the earth was still moving, I guess. So do landslides affect your planned construction projects?
Yeah, obviously they do. We do not get any additional money for landslides. So all the money that we're putting towards landslides is coming off of road and bridge projects, and it's really taking an impact right now. We only budgeted about $6 million over the past few years, and we spent over 20 last year. We're probably spending over 20 this year. Some of these landslides are costing $1 or $2 million on a road that may only have 100 vehicles a day. So we're having to balance where to put this money, which ones to fix. Some may not be fixed for a very long time.
And you're still dealing with ones from 2019.
Oh, we're still dealing with ones from 2016. There's some slides that we just haven't got to due to funding, and they don't have maybe some of the impacts that some of the other ones do.
So you say your budget has an increase, so you're taking away. How do you take it away, especially if it's a project that has a mix of maybe federal funds involved?
Yeah, if we start the design, we usually carry those federal funds to completion, or else we have to pay back the Federal Highway Administration. But what we're looking at here is maybe delaying some of those projects, not planning them. We really have a lot of paving we could do in the next 2 years, and some of that's going to be delayed to 2023, 2024, just because we don't have the funding to complete everything we need to.
And when you're planning a lot of these projects, I mean, they're years in advance as far as planning, right. But you can't. You have to react. You have to be more reactionary to the landslides. How do you prioritize the fixing of the landslide or the remediation of the landslides?
It's like we said, it's tough. Ones that have a higher traffic volume, ones that are, it's the only way to get in and out of a community, ones that are affecting businesses or school buses, they go to the high. We have a priority list where we actually prioritize all of them. Something like 51, though, that has 14,000 vehicles a day, that obviously goes right to the top. That has to get open as quick as we can. We're trying to open it, but we have to take a big rock mass down because we're not comfortable leaving it up on the hillside. So we have to look at all those things.
All right, one more on landslides. So you're still dealing with ones from last year, and you just head back all the way to 2016. We still also have had a wet winter and, oh my.
Yeah, we don't look forward to the rain coming this weekend. We do like it more than snow, but we really are concerned about some roads that have a lot of flooding. Streets Run Road, Katanning Pike, we're trying to figure out how to fix some of these roads that are notorious for flooding. Like we said, it takes money.
All right. Quickly, any efforts to beef up your money for landslides?
Not at the moment. We're working with our legislators, working with Congress, trying to hope that Congress does pass a transportation bill and gives the states additional money so we can use it to fix all the needs we have.
So you're looking for federal money rather than state money?
Well, we take help from anywhere we can get it, but we just haven't had a Congress hasn't passed a transportation bill in quite a few years.
Okay, in just about 20 seconds or so. So what is on your wish list, a major project that maybe doesn't have the funding yet that you really want to see get done?
Well, my wish list involves the interstates. We have Carnegie and Greentree interchanges under design, but we don't have them funded to improve both those interchanges. We also have work done on 79. We want to put three lanes near Bridgeville to connect to where the Southern Beltway is, and also 79 at 910. We want to improve that interchange. So my wish list mostly involves the interstates, fixing up some of these 60, 70-year-old interchanges.
Cheryl Siriani is the PennDOT District 11 executive. Cheryl, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. We'll talk with Darlene Harris, who for the first time in 13 years is not representing Pittsburgh's North Side on City Council. Then we'll look at a massage therapy location in Lawrenceville, making an effort to serve LGBT clients. And this summer, NASA will launch another rover to Mars to add to the findings of earlier rovers. Coming up, a conversation with the author of a new atlas of the Red Planet. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Ah, the eternal question. What do you get for the man who has it all? Well, the answer is pretty simple, actually. Don't get him anything. He can take care of himself. Jack White, the eccentric former frontman of the White Stripes and owner of Third Man Records, made an appearance on the hit TV show American Pickers on This Week in 2012. White met up with Mike Wolfe and Frank Fritz at their then-new Nashville outpost, where they traded White a taxidermied elephant head for the telephone booth used in one of his music videos and his first jukebox. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
Flood walls, earthen levees, and pump stations in the Ohio River Basin protect more than $120 billion in property and more than 700,000 people from rising waters. But is the infrastructure up to the task? This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. Some flood protection systems are deteriorating and rely on old equipment. Liam Niemeyer reports that as scientists predict climate change will increase the severity and frequency of flooding, Ohio Valley communities have little means to prepare for that future.
We're founded as a river and river.
Jim Casto walks along the towering, grime-coated flood walls in the city he has chronicled as a journalist and historian for much of his 78 years. It's the barrier between the Ohio River and downtown Huntington, West Virginia. But in 1937, there weren't any walls.
You look up there and see the 6'9", that is the 37 flood.
That's 69 feet of water, 19 feet above flood stage. Thousands in Huntington were forced from their homes. Cities from Paducah to Pittsburgh all saw destructive waters rise. About 1 million people lost homes, and more than 300 lost their lives. Many of the flood walls, levees, and pump stations in the Ohio River Basin were built in response to that disaster. Many are now more than 70 years old.
That's how it sounded going into the Frankenstein laboratory, wasn't it?
Mike Pemberton has been the flood defense manager for decades in Ironton, Ohio, 30 miles downstream from Huntington. He's given a tour of one of several pump stations built in the 1940s. He's had pump station engines and electrical equipment catch on fire. He's had to hunt down for replacements for parts so old, they're not even made anymore.
Things that's kind of got a question mark beside them, and you know, that's some of the things I kind of worry about.
Funding to repair or upgrade aging protections is hard to come by. Ironton issued a monthly $5 utility fee last year to begin to address the millions of dollars of upgrades needed. The Army Corps of Engineers classifies 12 flood protection projects in the basin as high risk of a malfunction or significant loss of life if a breach happened. Huntington Stormwater Utility Director Sherry Wilkins says it's hard to get state and federal funding when so many systems need help.
For example, in West Virginia, there might be 15 or 20 other municipalities or entities that are going after that same dollar amount that is available from FEMA.
And the American Society of Civil Engineers says flood protection across the country needs $80 billion to adequately protect communities. The threat of future flooding is growing thanks to our changing climate. Jim Noel is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service Ohio River Forecast Center. He helped author a 2017 Corps of Engineers report on climate change. The study projects a far warmer and wetter Ohio Valley by the end of the century. Many effects will be felt sooner, increasing the chance of disasters like floods.
However, beyond 2040, we may see additional either magnitude in terms of higher events or more frequent.
Army Corps of Engineers officials who annually inspect these flood protections say they expect them to perform despite their age. But the nagging doubts for the future remain for local leaders, including Mike Pemberton, who see their communities at risk.
What if? I guess is the two big words, what if.
That was Liam Niemeyer reporting for the Ohio Valley Resource, our partners in the Good River series about the Ohio River. More stories at ohiowatershed.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As Pittsburgh City Council began a new legislative session this week, one familiar voice was absent. Northside native Darlene Harris was defeated in last May's primary election and finds herself out of public life for the first time in more than a decade. 90.5 WESA's Ariel Worthy sat down with Harris as she prepared to leave office earlier this month.
It's just days before Harris is set to leave City Council. She's in her City Council office, surrounded by hard hats from projects in her Northside district, documents to sort through, and a leftover bag of doggy treats for four-legged visitors. Taped to a filing cabinet is a picture of a bull and a naval vessel. It's a memento of a heated council debate where Harris was accused of swearing on record.
I said bullshit, okay. And make sure you hear what I said.
That controversy made headlines 4 years ago. But today, Harris laughs at the memory.
If you don't have a little bit of humor in what you're doing, then you shouldn't really be here.
Harris has been in the public eye for nearly half a century. First as an advocate for her Spring Hill neighborhood, then later as a Pittsburgh Public School Board member. On council, she often opposed Mayor Bill Peduto, entangled with City Councilor Bruce Krause. But she says she doesn't hold grudges.
Somebody like Bruce, I figure it's easier not talking to him.
Krause himself says he wishes her luck.
I wish Councilwoman Harris everything good in life that it has to offer for her.
But hours after making those remarks, he publicly accused Harris of taking gifts that had been given to the city. Harris says the gifts were given to her personally. But she's often been at the center of that kind of dispute. And when asked if there's anyone she'll miss on council, she says,
I don't know. It hasn't been the same as it was with the older councils.
Duquesne Law Professor Joseph Sabino Mystic says Harris's leaving reflects a changing city.
Darlene Harris represents old Pittsburgh to the extent that she's been around to see the changes, and that gives her some invaluable insight into institutional memory that is hard to replace.
Mystic says Harris would force the administration to explain itself.
We're going to lose that dissenting voice, that person who calls other public officials on the carpet.
Some Harris critics say she represents a Pittsburgh that can be intolerant. But Harris has pointed out that she's been more likely to hire black staffers than her white colleagues. And she says she's never forgotten her working class roots, which is why she's proud of never voting to raise taxes on residents.
I grew up very, very, very poor. My mom took us to neighbors to eat, and my grandma would make my clothes. I know what struggling is. And I lived through all that as a child, and I guess I think of those people that don't have much and what you're doing to them.
Harris's childhood explains another of her key issues. Growing up, Harris said her family always had pets.
I had two little raccoon pets, one baby groundhog. Always had turtles because turtles were always around the house. Frogs, I mean, we always had nice-sized frogs.
A spokesman for the pet advocacy organization Animal Friends says Harris was, quote, fantastic to work with. She passed several laws for animals, including offering pensions for police canine dogs. Her last council accomplishment came after several alligators were found roaming in the city. She proposed bills to require people to register dangerous snakes and to keep reptilian pets secure in their homes. After decades in the public eye, Harris says she's looking forward to keeping her eye on her five grandchildren.
I had a lot of good years, and I enjoyed it. And actually, it probably stayed a little over what someone would do, but time to give that time to my family.
I'm Ariel Worthy, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been 1 year since Body Euphoria Inclusive Massage Therapy opened in Upper Lawrenceville. The business is run by Eli Shoemaker, a massage therapist, who says he wanted to create a positive experience for his clients, especially those who identify as LGBT. 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley started by asking Shoemaker about his original concept for Body Euphoria.
The original concept for Body Euphoria is pretty on point with where we're at now. The underlying principle of all bodies are good bodies. I know that from my own experience, being a body worker and getting body work all over the city, you still, when you're going to see somebody for the first time, you really don't know what they're thinking or what they're going to ask you or if they're going to use your incorrect pronouns. Or if they're going to say something about the way your body is, the way your chest is, or the way this looks, or the way this is. And even if that doesn't happen, it's always a concern at the back of my mind, and I'm a body worker. And I have found that to be true over the course of this year, that there are so many people in this community who need body work desperately, and they haven't gotten it for years and years and years and years because they don't feel comfortable going to a massage therapist and having to find out whether it's going to be a safe massage that's relaxing for them or if it's just going to be an anxiety-inducing experience, which is not what massage is about.
So how do you combat that? I mean, how do you make this space inclusive?
Well, first of all, the business is trans-owned and operated. We strive to be very radically body positive here. And continually examine all the things that means.
What do you specialize in?
I specialize in myofascial release, but a lot of clients come to see me for injuries, chronic pain, what I like to call desk body. You know, you sit at a desk for 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week or more. As listeners, I'm sitting in your cars. I'm sure that you know what I'm talking about. Your shoulders are hunched forward and you get that spot, right? between your neck and your shoulder. Don't really know what it is, but yeah, everybody's got it. So people come to see me for that. I also specialize in treating people who chest bind, which is a thing that you see a lot in the transgender and gender nonconforming folks.
What's been the most challenging aspect of running this business?
The most challenging part for me has been learning marketing. That's not like a world that I came from. So that's been challenging, and it's a really important skill to have in any business. But I've definitely gotten better with it. I mean, jump into the deep end, right? That's been one of my major challenges.
Can you share or tell us some of what you've heard from your clients over the past year? Any anecdotes that like stand out to you?
I have one client that just really stands out when you ask that question. They have been coming to see me since I opened last year, and regularly, like more than once a month, mostly like 3 or 4 times a month. And this is one of those people that I'm talking about, someone who's transgender and has some serious medical issues and health issues that really massage is the best answer for. And they've not been able to seek that kind of care. It's a progressive thing, the thing that they deal with, and it's something that we can slow with massage therapy. And so it's really rewarding to be able to see someone who needs the work that I do be able to get quality work and feel safe in the space that they get it.
So what's next? What are you looking forward to going into your second year?
This year, I'm really looking forward to seeing a lot more clients. I'm looking forward to Pride this year. We're going to be adding services this year. I'm looking to add other practitioners. And we're expanding our retail this year, and that's exciting to me, too. A lot of the stuff that we make, or a lot of the stuff that we sell, is stuff that we make in-house as far as foot scrubs and muscle rubs, and yeah.
Eli Shoemaker, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That's WESA's Katie Blackley talking with Body Euphoria owner Eli Shoemaker. It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When you look at Mars in a picture or through a telescope, you might notice the reddish hue or even some of its craters, but there's a lot we still don't know about the geography of our planetary neighbor. Kenneth Coles is the lead author of The Atlas of Mars, a book of maps of the red planet's surface, an associate professor in the geoscience department, and he's also planetarium director at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. And he joins us in studio now. Ken, welcome to The Confluence.
Nice to be with you.
The Atlas of Mars, it's a project 8 years in the making?
Yes.
And it updates the last atlas published by NASA in the 1970s. So why was it important to update it now? What have we learned since the 70s about Mars?
Of course, there's been a gradual increase over the years in understanding. There was a gap in study of Mars after the Viking project of the 1970s, the landers and orbiters. Starting in 1996, there have been robotic missions orbiting Mars since then and several landers and rovers. And so we have a lot of new information. There are now over 2.5 million pictures of Mars. I'm sure no human has looked at them all. And there have been instruments we didn't have in the 1970s when the previous atlas was done.
15 years ago, twin rovers discovered evidence that there was once running water on the planet. Then a larger rover, Curiosity, landed in 2012 and has been exploring a huge crater since. How has the data gathered from those rovers helped with this new Atlas of Mars?
It amounts to what we call ground truth, which lets you interpret measurements you've made from orbit. One of the things that's been done since 1996 is to take infrared images of Mars, which lets us identify what kinds of minerals and chemicals are on the surface, but only in a general way. You can calibrate or understand and interpret those measurements better if you have a few locations on the ground where you know what's there. And that's what the rovers have been so superb at doing, because they're equipped to make analyses on the spot and to understand what chemicals and what minerals are present.
So give us an idea. What does the new atlas look like compared to the older one that you brought them both into studio?
The new one, of course, is done in color. It's published by Cambridge Press, and they did a very nice job on the production. We tried to utilize color whenever it helped you to see things like elevation, examples of processes on the surface, because many of the images we have are in color. We also try to include, they did it in large format, which is really great, so we can make things big enough to give you a good idea of what you're looking at. And then you can compare things side by side. Much of this information is out there, but it was all separated. And so this is a matter of synthesis, of pulling things together to give people an idea of what we know.
How did you get involved with mapping Mars, with understanding that, and your interest maybe in other planets?
Well, planetary science has fascinated me since I was growing up in Pasadena during the race to the moon. And some of my playmates had parents who were working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and the robotic missions. I went through school and studied geology. And while I became an earth geologist and had a number of other jobs, I always kept in touch with planetary science, and I used it in my teaching whenever I could. It's a great hook for students of all ages and adults to say, let's look at a picture of the moon or a picture of another body and ask, how would you interpret it? Planetary science is so new that an untrained pair of eyes can see much of what an expert can see. How did I get involved in this? I had a sabbatical coming up at IUP. I wanted to get some renewal as a scientist. That's supposed to be the purpose of a sabbatical, to make you a better teacher. I contacted a colleague from the old days, Ken Tanaka. Ken Tanaka is probably the person who's made more geologic maps of Mars than anybody. He works at the U.S. Geological Survey in Flagstaff, Arizona. We have in that office the best planetary mappers in the world. That office began to train the Apollo astronauts. And he invited me to get involved in this project.
Our guest on The Confluence is a geoscientist and planetarium director at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, and he is the lead author of The Atlas of Mars. It's Ken Coles. Ken, you mentioned one of your co-authors on this project, Ken Tanaka, the Geological Survey astrogeology team, and Philip Christensen, from Arizona State University?
Arizona State. Phil Christensen has been involved with planetary missions for a long time, and he is the principal investigator, that is the person in charge of the Themis camera, which has been orbiting Mars for close to two decades now, and it takes infrared images, which allow us to see things like temperature, behavior. You can do analysis of what minerals are present, and you can figure out where you have rock and where you have dust.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of dust on Mars.
Is it frozen dust?
Well, it blows around a lot. Okay. That depiction you see in the movies is certainly the case. It's a dusty place.
So how does this collaboration process work? You have three individuals in different locations.
Yeah, well, I did, of course, start this project at Flagstaff on sabbatical, and I went down to talk to Phil at Arizona State several times. But the reason I ended up being first, not because I'm the biggest expert, but because I'm the pair of hands that was able to had the time to get the work done. And so Ken Tanaka contributed a lot of the geology and geographic synthesis, something he's acknowledged as being an expert in. Phil helped us a lot with constructing the maps and the global data sets. And they all had input and reviewed everything we wrote. It was a big project, but it was fascinating all the way through. I never got tired of working on it, although it took a lot of nights and weekends.
How do you make various maps and then combine them into an atlas of Mars when you can't visit the planet?
Yeah, exactly. It's a matter of what we call remote sensing. That's our knowledge of Mars and many other bodies in the solar system is given to us by spacecraft, by machines we have built. And you have to practice with similar instruments on Earth, take pictures of things you know and compare them, and then you can interpret what you have and figure out how to present it. The ground truth from the rovers and landers has been a big help, of course, in giving us a little bit dose of reality until a person goes there. And, of course, that's a very challenging matter. It's much easier to send a machine to a place like Mars than a person.
Do we have images of, in a sense, I'll say every square foot of Mars, or is there anything that's lacking as far as images?
Well, the global coverage, there's global coverage at a resolution from the Themis camera, 18 meters, about 50 feet. So you could see things as big as a building. There is a European spacecraft, Mars Express, which is close to imaging the entire planet about three times that detail.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are cameras which have only imaged tiny amounts of the surface, but they're good enough that they could see if the rovers are double parked.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Small areas in great detail, and the whole planet has been covered actually by a number of instruments now, so it's well known.
Earlier you said the project 8 years in the making. Was there ever, being scientists, always wanting to learn more, always wanting to know more, was there ever a point where we said, well, we can't do it yet. We can't do it yet. We still need to know this before we actually publish?
Well, I think one of the things you have to do is be comfortable presenting, here's what we know, here's what we don't know. And one of the things I advocated as the lead author was we weren't going to, if there are competing explanations for something, we're not going to pick one and take sides. What I wanted to do was present the various possible ideas. Why are the volcanoes so large? Why is the largest canyon in the solar system on Mars? We're not sure why it formed, oddly enough, even though it was discovered nearly half a century ago, the Valles Marineris. My impression is when I listen to all the explanations and we have that many possibilities, we don't know which one is correct yet. So science is not just a bunch of answers you memorize. It's a way of asking questions. That's what I tell my students.
Well, what questions do you still have then?
Well, a particular larger question, and it gets a lot of attention from scientists. We see dry gullies and dry stream canyons. We see the mineralogical and other features found by the rovers. Clearly, there was water, and Mars must have been different. You can't have water today on Mars. It would either freeze and evaporate or evaporate immediately, depending where you are. Conditions must have been different. And one big question is, was it warm and wet for a few weeks or a few years or a million years? How long does it take to make these features? It's a big mystery.
This book was designed to target a broad readership. Why was that important to you instead of, you know, targeting experts, scientists, your colleagues?
Well, in a way, the true specialists and experts probably don't need this book, but a lot of them have told me they're going to have their new graduate students read it. If you're a determined reader, we did have to use some geological terminology in this book, so we put a glossary in there. It might be a little bit like reading Scientific American if you're not a scientist. But we thought the people who've helped support and pay for these missions should see what we've learned. You could say, well, what use is it? And it's true that what I do to serve the taxpayers of Indiana is teach their children astronomy, something they arguably don't need to know. This is the cloudiest place I've ever lived. But on the other hand, the classes fill up. People are curious, and they do learn about scientific thinking, which is important if you're assessing, for example, medical treatments. How do we think about scientific reasoning?
Mm-hmm. Specifically, what do you hope that non-scientists, I'm pointing to myself right now, take away from the Atlas?
How surprising nature is. It's funny, truth is stranger than fiction, and there have been many marvelous and still are fictional accounts of what people will find when they explore space. And every time we visit a planet with a robotic spacecraft or one of the moons of the outer planets, it's always a complete surprise. You have to invent a whole new science every time you go to one of these places. There's never a dull moment. It's astonishing.
NASA is planning a robotic mission to Mars in 2020. Does that mean more info for you and maybe an addendum to this atlas?
Certainly you could... It would make sense to revisit a lot of the conclusions and generalizations after we have some results from Mars 2020. And Mars 2020 will collect and cache, that is, store in particular locations samples. And the hope is that another mission can go and retrieve them. Now, that's going to be complicated, and it's going to take a few years. And it's hard to say if it will happen, if the decision will be that it's worth the effort and the resources that it will take. But certainly Mars 2020 has been targeted to look at some of the places that have clearly been wet to see if the minerals that you find in the ground correspond with what we think we see from orbit.
All right. So when do you think us humans will get there, or will we get there?
My own personal opinion, and I should label it as such, is that provided we can keep ourselves together as a species, we don't end in some disaster, and I'm optimistic about that, somebody will get there eventually. We shouldn't assume that it's going to be us, although if we keep up our effort, the United States has done very well in space and certainly has a lot of expertise. But somebody will certainly try it one of these days.
Ken Coles is a geoscientist at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. He's lead author of The Atlas of Mars. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, hear from the new leader behind the local arm of the largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization in the nation. Christine Mohammed joins us on Monday. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Julia Zenkovich, Caldwell Holden, and Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.